You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 29th of September 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller. On today's show, a big week for fans of self-determination as Kurdistan votes and Catalonia prepares to. My guests from Monocle's office here in London and from our bureau in Zurich, Hong Kong and New York will be discussing this and the stories from their beats, including the latest commemoration of Hong Kong's umbrella protests, a plan to make Swiss trains even better, and when is Kraft Coffee no longer Kraft Coffee? That's all coming up on Midori House on Monocle 24 right now. Welcome to Midori House. We will hear from our bureaus presently. That's bureaus with an X, of course, the plural. But first, here in the studio, I am joined by Monocle's editor, Andrew Tuck, and our features editor, Chris Lord. Welcome both. And we will start with a tale of two independence referendums, one of which occurred earlier this week, the other of which occurs this weekend. In the Kurdish region of Iraq, a predictably thumping majority voted yes, presenting the region and those concerned with it with another headache for their already voluminous collections. In the Catalonian region of Spain, the outcome is less predictable, as is the degree to which it's actually going to be permitted to go ahead. Chris, first of all, are we setting ourselves here something of a false opposition in thinking of these things as two related phenomena? Do they actually have all that much in common?
I mean, obviously, the most thing that they do have in common is the fact that both of them, both referendums, are absolutely not what the central government want to happen, and they're happening despite the protests of central
Indeed
government
so.
In the case of Madrid and in the case of Baghdad. But the terms, I would argue, are pretty different. I mean, the Catalans really, their independence drive is very, very different. Their history is completely different from the experience of the Kurds in the 20th century. We have to remember that only, you know, a couple of decades ago under Saddam Hussein, the Kurds were being gassed in their own cities in Iraq. And similarly, you know, they have all over the region experienced pressure to deny who they are. So I don't think the Catalans have that in common. I think maybe perhaps one other thing that we could draw something is that you're talking about the two extremely productive regions of their respective countries, Catalonia being
Indeed.
Extremely productive, and Iraqi Kurdistan being extremely productive as well. I think this is maybe the point to make here, is that you have this extremely productive region which the central government in Iraq, Haider al-Abadi, the PM, has now this afternoon instated a flight ban for foreign flights going into the Kurdish region. This is a shocking idea, not only for the people of Kurdistan, but for his country. I mean, it's the advisory thing of what you don't do in this scenario, because you've got this extremely productive region, the centre in many cases of the international organizations that want to access places that have been reclaimed from Islamic State. You're cutting that off from the world. It's not going to end well. And however it goes on Sunday, I think, you know, in a very, very different way, the government of Spain, the central government, can learn something from this scenario. You've got to listen to people. You can't just shut them off.
Andrew, is there anything either central government can do that isn't the wrong thing?
Well, I think in the instance of Catalonia, is very difficult to see what they can do. They see this as an illegal attempt to hold a vote and to break apart Spain. So the central government has every right to act and to do what it deems necessary. But the trouble is, every single thing it does will rile even moderates, who maybe even the undecided will become more decided that they should actually go for independence, because up until now, you know, Spain has been able to have a reasonably soft touch in Catalonia and to allow the Catalans to run their territory. Now, suddenly, when you have people being arrested, when you have a judgment coming from Madrid saying the vote will not go ahead on Sunday, we have sent in enough police, it looks like it begins to look like a bit of a military attempt to stop things, even though it's not the military, even though it is the police. And then you tap into the history of the Civil War, and you tap into all other kind of long, deep stories, which are still sensitive and which will only go wrong for central government. So, you know, I have some empathy for those people in Madrid who are thinking, OK, how do we show our displeasure at this? but how do we make sure that, you know, the vote doesn't go ahead? And I don't know what they can do. And the other thing to say is that it's become so fraught that I would imagine if you were a Catalan who wanted to remain part of Spain, it's very unlikely that you would vote on Sunday anyway. So the other interesting thing that is, even if they step back now and say the vote should go ahead, I don't think it would be a full and fair reading of the sentiment of Catalonia. I'm sure the majority of people do want independence, but I think that if you were a no voter, you would not go out to a poll.
Just staying with that, Andrew, and you're quite right, of course, and if you think back here in the UK a couple of years, I think if London had sent police and soldiers to Scotland to try and forestall the independence referendum, there's little doubt about which way that vote would have ended up going. But the case itself for Catalonian independence, is there one, or is at this point, with all due respect to that history that you mentioned, is the idea of desiring freedom from the iron grip of Madrid a little bit self-indulgent at this point?
Well, there was always a case here in the UK. You know, the Cornish, some of the Cornish would like independence, and there's no, and you know, they have a right. They have a more Celtic root than other Brits, and they are a territory you can mark out on a map. Why not? But you know, we've sat in this studio many times arguing about Brexit, and my feeling is that, on the whole, that sentiment about collaboration and unification and joining together and helping each other and actually not only being with people like yourself, that is being lost again and again. And that was something that perhaps the thing I despise most about the debate about Brexit. It became a question of, we want to be surrounded by people like us. Now, for the Catalans, I understand this is a fraught moment and an important moment for them. But that desire to only be around your own people is tricky. And, you know, when you're in Barcelona, many friends who've moved there, who've lived in the city, said, you know, it's fine for the first few months, but you'll notice that if you don't learn Catalan pretty quickly, people don't like speaking to you in Spanish. They don't like outsiders. They don't like bending towards any kind of integration with Spain. So there, I think that's the thing I don't like. And then if you follow this route, you know, and if everybody wants to go back to how things used to be, let's see the breaking up and the dissembling of the parts of Italy. Why shouldn't there be a revival of the Sicilian kingdom? Why shouldn't Württemberg come back as a nation state? Because those are all the parts where people actually in the past said, look, you know, we have some shared interests here. We're not all the same. And you go to Germany, you're in Munich or you're in Hanover, people keep their cultural identity. They're not the same. But they took a brave decision to, yeah, maybe it was forced here and there, but they came together and they unified around something. And that's in this dissembling, that is what you lose.
And just before we move along onto other things, Chris, if we look at Kurdistan, is it viable as a thing? Because there's, with Kurdistan and the Kurds, as you pointed out, I think there's a perfectly reasonable case that they can make for why we want a country. And at this point, especially given their contribution to the war against Islamic State, why we deserve one, frankly. But there's a difference between that and then actually making it work, especially if it's a landlocked country surrounded by neighbours who wish it wasn't there.
Well, to answer that question, I've recently just come back from the Faroe Islands, which is just north of Scotland. And there's a whole talk at the moment about their potential independence from Denmark. And the point that I think kept coming back when I talked to people there was, you know, there's this whole level in any kind of independence referendum or debate like this, which sits beyond pragmatics of economics, governance and so on. It's this whole other spring in people's psyche that exists as, what if? What if we did this? What if we went that way? And you can't ever really damn it. I mean, it is one of those things that will remain beyond the arguments about, oh, you couldn't do it, the economics wouldn't ever work. To come back to Kurdistan as a concept, they've already shown that it does work. I mean, since the invasion of Iraq in 2003, since then, the KRG, the Kurdistan Regional Government, has shown that it can create a state within a state. And not just that, but it provides so much energy around the world, for instance. It provides so much in terms of stability. It presents an access point to Iraq for the international community. It is a place which still operates with so much autonomy simply because of the chaos in Baghdad. And part of the reason I would argue for that is because you do have, as Andrew mentioned, you do have shared interests there, which are, whether we like it or not, an ethnic interest. It is something that connects people. And that's what they don't have broader in Iraq.
Chris, without getting too caught up in the moment in time, the other difference is, these are people who are spread across three or four countries. They're not all, like the Catalans, all within one country where you can negotiate with one central government. They are secularists. They are welcoming of other religions. And they have been encouraged to be a semi-autonomous region by the West, by the US. And they've done that. They've done it effectively. They've been super successful in fighting IS in Syria. And for them, you do feel there should be some reward at the end of this process for their people being killed and for the bravery of their men and women. And for the fact that they provide, within the heart of this region, a model for what Islam can look like with a face that is actually quite understandable by all the world and is engaged with everyone's politics and actually has a kind of laissez-faire attitude towards people's personal lives and also what the rest of the world does.
Okay, well, you can hear much more about Kurdistan on tomorrow's edition of The Foreign Desk at midday London time or whenever you like after that on our website. We're going to take a short break now. Up next, we'll be joined by Monocle's Hong Kong Bureau as we look at the third anniversary of the Umbrella Movement. This is Midori House. Do stay tuned.
Subscribe today to become part of the Monocle family. From product design to the best places to go, Monocle will bring a monthly dose of fresh ideas to your door. Being part of the family also comes with a 10% discount at the shop and online, as well as unlimited access to our online archive. In addition, you will enjoy priority access to selected product collaborations and receive exclusive offers and invitations around the world. Subscriptions start from £55. For more information, visit monocle.com/subscribe.
You are back with Midori House on Monocle 24. Chris Lord and Andrew Tuck are still with me. We're also joined now by Kurt Lin from Monocle's Bureau in Hong Kong, where this week yellow umbrellas were unfurled once again in commemoration of the third anniversary of the huge pro-democracy protests which became known as the Umbrella Movement. The protesters' demands for full democracy remain unanswered. Kurt, first of all, these latest protests or commemorations, call them what you will, we saw this week, how big a deal were they compared, I guess, to the original Umbrella Movement?
I think quite a lot of people in the general public already get a little bit disengaged from the Umbrella Movement because they do feel there's not much achievement that they've made over the last 3 years. But actually, there's still a great deal of people, great deal of like big group of people, hundreds of people with a symbolic yellow umbrella went to the scene outside of the headquarters of the government. That happened 3 years ago, the whole breakdown, and thousands of young people protested against the government back then. So the 28th of September 3 years ago was a key day to actually symbolize the confrontation between the government and the people in Hong Kong. I think that's what we have learned as the younger pro-democracy people in Hong Kong, that what they need to fight back and what they need to bear in mind when they confront the bigger power in front of them.
So how strong is the pro-democracy movement in Hong Kong now? You said in the 3 years since the Umbrella protests, which are perhaps perceived as something of an ultimate failure, that interest in it has petered out a bit. Is universal full suffrage still something that really matters to people?
It really matters to people. A lot of people still keep fighting for this goal or as their life goal. And actually, a lot of young people, including a couple of young legislators who actually turned their whole career into being a politician or the activists to fight for the full referendum for Hong Kong, which some people regard the whole action or the whole movement as a failure because they haven't achieved anything. But three of them, two activists and Joshua Wong, are now imprisoned for their protest 3 years ago, happened 3 years ago. But a lot of people still regard them as sort of the icon or the goal to fight for the democracy in Hong Kong. And I think they're... The morale is really high in Hong Kong now. A lot of young people got very politically engaged, which is unprecedented. Because before, a lot of talk about the future of Hong Kong would be just economic related.
God, it's very easy for us when we sit here in the UK. I think you begin to imagine that people liked it the way it was. It was so much easier under the English and the British, rather, Hangzhou, that you, people had a better time then. But actually, when you speak to people, I think, in Hong Kong, it's much more complex than that. You know, the people I've met, you know, when we've done events, they're young people like yourselves. Yes, they have many questions about what's happening with the central government in Beijing, but that doesn't mean they're opposed to all things from the mainland. They're doing business there, they're traveling there, they're very engaged with it. They want this cross-border, but they just kind of want to hold on to some of that, you know, that sense that they are a little bit different and that those rights are protected. But just explain to us, what, you know, even for yourself, when you look at towards Beijing and Hong Kong, what's your relationship as, you know, as a Chinese person living in Hong Kong?
I think Chris Patten, the last British governor of Hong Kong and the Chancellor of Oxford, just came to Hong Kong or went to Hong Kong to have a sort of book sales tour. But at the same time, whenever he's back in Hong Kong, he got asked by lots of journalists about his views about Hong Kong. And he actually points out the crux of the issue is the identical problems. Like for a lot of Hong Kong Chinese, like especially after the Umbrella Movement, if you ask the Hong Kong people, where are you from? They would specifically tell you they're from Hong Kong rather than Chinese. And there is such a big argument on whether they're Chinese or whether they're Hong Kong Chinese. Same in Taiwan. Are they Taiwanese or are they Chinese? There's a lot of philosophical debate about that. And also that gets too political sometimes. I think the identical problem get into the too black and white approach. Because when you're a Hong Kong Chinese, and when you're a mainland Chinese, there is not mutually excluding each other. And you can actually do business in China while you're very pro-democracy, but or vice versa as well. So I think the crux of the discussion what the Umbrella Movement symbolized, the whole era of the Hong Kong, was it tears down the Hong Kong. It makes confrontation very badly between the government and the general public. I think what Hong Kong needs to do, like Chris Patten actually noted at his speech at the Foreign Correspondent Club in Hong Kong, that he said the senior officials in the government or the people in power in Hong Kong, they need to start talking to the people rather than making confrontation or antagonism.
Kurt, can I just jump in? I wanted to ask you a question about one thing, which is we see this phenomenon in mainland China whereby lots of young people have become, and it is quite a broad phenomenon, become extremely fanatical about the party, about the government, about what happens in Beijing. They believe it to the nth degree. Now, you were just talking then about, you know, there is degradation. Not everybody, it's not quite as black and white. I'm Hong Kong and I'm Chinese and so on. But in Hong Kong, has that penetrated at all? Do you get many young people who, despite the history that's there, who actually do feel that same, they share in that same level of, you know, essentially, you know, diehard, hardcore nationalism towards China?
I think the degree is quite different between Hong Kong and China, because especially under the regime or the administration of Xi Jinping, he's been pushing so much nationalism, education and propaganda over the last 4 or 5 years.
And do young Hongkongese people, do they buy into that as well?
Not quite. Chinese or Beijing has a different understanding of being soft or being hard. When they try to do things more effectively in Hong Kong, it doesn't work. So I think it comes down to a little bit of a marketing or branding issue. How do they sell the idea to the Hong Kong people?
Kurt Lin, thank you for joining us. And we're joined now by Carlo Silberschmidt from Monocle's bureau in Zurich. And Switzerland is, of course, proverbial as a country where the trains run on time. There will presently be even more of them. Switzerland proposes to spend another 11.5 billion francs on the network by 2035, building new lines, new stations, and further improving what is already there. Carlo, I think for most of us who are accustomed to less fabulous railways than you have in Switzerland, we might struggle to imagine where you're going to find 11.5 billion francs worth of improvements. What is it the money getting spent on?
So actually, the government wanted to spend even more. We had plans for 30 billion Swiss francs being spent.
These were going to be gold-plated trains pulled by unicorns.
Maybe. No, but there are many, many projects still due in Switzerland. And it's not gold plates, but it's coping with the higher and higher capacities needed to deliver the same quality of service that we have right now.
So what does Switzerland? Sweden's trains also very nice, however, but what does Switzerland still need that it doesn't actually already have?
It's kind of a challenge that we have right now. We have such a high frequency. We have one of the highest frequency of train travels on our tracks right now, and this asks for really high maintenance, and these costs are rising, but means also that we need constantly new train stock, new rolling material.
I wanted to ask you, it was fascinating when you go to Switzerland that, you know, here's an extremely wealthy country, but in fact, people really like travelling by public transport. You know, even in a city like Zurich, where we have our office, where you're based, you know, 60-70% of people are going to work on the tram rather than trying to drive into the city centre. What does public transport mean to the Swiss? Are Swiss very proud of their public transport?
We are really, really proud. even though there is one moment when a Swiss person goes to Japan, there is a bit of
seething, jealous rage.
Yeah, when you see a nice Shinkansen.
You size each other up a little bit.
Absolutely, absolutely. But then again, you're right. Everyone is on public transport. It's just the more convenient way to travel around town.
But is it just also because everybody's on public transport because the public transport's really nice? If I lived in Switzerland, I think I'd just live on the train. I mean, you don't want to get off. They're wonderful.
Yeah, but it's amazing when some years ago we went to a story about one of the guys who worked for the tram authority, and he was saying that, you know, if you get on the tram in the morning, you can see the president going to work on the tram. You can see that the heads of all the biggest corporations in Zurich. Everybody has this affection for public transport, and that's why I guess the train service is so good, because there's not that thing here in the UK, for example, where extremely wealthy people who are influential maybe in Parliament don't go on public transport, so they don't really care that much whether it's good or bad. But if you're the chairman of a company and you want all your team to get to work safely in the morning and on time, then everybody loves the public transport.
I mean, Chris, we are living here in the UK, whose railways are in many important respects very unlike those of Switzerland. Mm. Is there a particular reason for that? Why can't we all have trains like Switzerland's?
Well, I think that to answer that question, you've got to think about why the Swiss love the public transport as much as they do. And it's not just because it runs so great. It's not just, you know, it's a sense of national pride. I do genuinely think that one of the reasons is because they feel so close to the decisions that are made about that public transport. You know,
To advocate more referendums, Chris? That's a bold move.
Look, Andrew, I've been writing all week about direct democracy, and I have to say, I've been sort of quite intrigued by it. I mean, it gives you this incredible sense of how involved people feel in the decisions of the state. I mean, Carly, you can probably answer for me, but you do get this real sense when you look at the way direct democracy works. They know the way the budget's being spent. They know what kind of decisions are being made. And also, I think there's a kind of trust in SBB as well. I mean, these guys, the rail company there, they're entrepreneurial thinkers. I mean, if you look at some of the things that they've done in the last few years in terms of building around the railway stations to make them more profitable, in terms of real estate, to fund the main thing.
Is it all state-owned?
It is mostly state-owned. There is like some private companies operating the trains. That is also a really big discussion, whether it should be more privatized or not. But coming back to SBB, there are two interesting things. One is that SBB as a brand is really, really well regarded amongst the Swiss. And the second interesting topic is that SBB has been making a lot of money from the real estate around the train stations, renting that out, new building projects that have shaped the city of Zurich and other cities are really important to fund the rail transport system as we have it now.
Carlo Silberschmidt, thank you for joining us. And do think of us when you're back in Switzerland, sitting on one of those lovely curved couches that you have upstairs, even in economy class. Why can't we all have nice things? You're listening to Midori House. We'll be back shortly. And finally today, we are joined by Charles McFarlane from Monocle's Bureau in New York. And like every other city in the world, New York has in recent years become substantially a large gathering of people selling boutique craft coffee to each other. As an inevitable consequence of such, old school big business has taken an interest. There are those who perceive dismal portent in the news that Blue Bottle, which began life as a small roaster in Oakland in 2002 before expanding across the US, is to be bought by Nestlé, who are paying roughly $425 million for 68% of the company. Charles, is this really anything but capitalism just doing what it does? are the streets of Brooklyn full of people weeping into their Blue Bottle coffee at what their brand has become?
I think there definitely are some fans who are weeping into their Blue Bottle, as you say. I think, but more importantly, people are asking the question, what does it really mean for what they've called third wave coffee? Why should we still care about the origin of where coffee is coming from and how it's being made when it's being bought up by bigger and bigger companies?
Well, which is an entirely fair question. And I guess before we look at whether the Blue Bottle brand is damaged by this, Charles, how would Blue Bottle define itself? What does Blue Bottle like to think of as its own brand?
I think they like to think of themselves as a sort of an independent company that really wanted to try to bring great single origin coffee to consumers. And they also really pioneered pre-packaged coffee. So, you know, there's a whole line of pre-made Blue Bottles you could buy in a grocery store. They also have shops in Japan as well. So they got pretty big, but they stayed pretty scrappy. And sort of with Nestlé buying them, it's really a change of pace for them.
I thought it was fascinating that the owners said that lots of people were quoting them. They were invited to go and see Nestlé, and it was actually Nestlé's passion for real coffee that persuaded them that this was the deal to go for, not the $425 million.
But that's the sort of thing you always...
No.
If somebody wanted to pay me $425 million for 68% of what I do, and I'm open to offers, I would be willing to put my name to a press release saying literally anything.
15, 16 years ago, we had exactly the same story with the ice cream sector. The ice cream sector was owned by all the big players, and there were suddenly all these innovative people came along, including two nice Jewish guys from New York called Ben and Jerry. Now, they created this incredible brand, which is now owned by Unilever. Now, interestingly, Unilever don't have anything to do with Ben and Jerry anymore, who I think were arrested during one of the Democratic campaigns for their campaigns. But some of their hippiness, oddly, has remained alive within that brand. So they still campaign on lots of issues. They're still very outspoken. They've just recently been running a campaign in Australia where you can't get two scoops of the same flavour ice cream in a Ben and Jerry's shop. And they say they won't allow you to have two scoops the same until Australia agrees for same-sex marriage. And I think that's it. This is a company within the Unilever brand which have been hands-off. So these can sit within an organisation. The same with a juice brand here in the UK that everyone loved, Innocent, bought by Coca-Cola, sits within it. So it's just the nature of these things. If you become actually a brand that's worth millions of dollars, then the only people who are going to buy you are not going to be the other nice mom-and-pop coffee store. It's going to be one of the big players.
Chris, I mean, I don't know about you. I like coffee. I drink a lot of it. I'm not always particularly interested in reading the backstory printed on the rear of the packet. Would this make any particular difference to you if your favourite coffee manufacturer, whomever it was bought by an even bigger one?
I don't think it would necessarily make a big difference. I mean, I think there's possibly a case that maybe we've become a little bit overwhelmed by these tales. Like, so much of what we encounter in terms of food and drink now comes with these added backstories and little disclaimers in the back about where and how great it is, where they've come from. I'm not saying that's necessarily a bad thing, but it is a little bit being bought into. And I think the fact that Nestlé is now purchasing it, they want to get a bit of that capital themselves. I mean, Nestlé itself is, it's not a stranger to scandal from its own company as well.
It is
and
not.
I'm sure this is all part and parcel, possibly, of trying to show that they are lovers of coffee too, of real old-fashioned, good old-fashioned coffee. I think to just say something, echo in a way what Andrew said, really, I think also as well, what's interesting as well is about this in a positive sense, is that what we have seen since this explosion of craft in terms of coffee and food and drink and so on, is that because you've got these smaller producers and smaller businesses that have had to kind of tussle with the reality of being smaller and making sure that everybody is served correctly in that value chain, what we're now probably seeing is it is having that effect on bigger business. So if we wanted to be very, very positive about this, thing here. You know, you walk into any supermarket now and everybody will trumpet how small and craft their sourced sausages are. Do you see what I mean? That has become a major part of the thing. And I think, you know, if we wanted to be positive, we could say that what has happened in recent years because of this craft boom, it's pushed bigger businesses to take more responsibility for where they get their stuff from. It's not always airtight, but it has been a change across the board.
So, Charles, is Blue Bottle's reputation going to survive this?
I think they will. I don't think it's going to damage the brand overall. I think what's more interesting for Nestle is that while they, you know, with Nespresso, they've really cornered as far as, you know, sort of buying coffee prepackaged in these K-cups, they have almost no presence in a cafe environment. And with Blue Bottle, they're getting 40-some-odd cafes that I think we're going to see in the next year or so explode well beyond that.
That brings us to the end of today's show. Thanks to all of our guests today, Charles McFarlane, Carlos Schorbeschmidt, Kurt Lynn, Chris Lord, and Andrew Tuck. Today's show was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, Sophia Amadi, and Katie Watkins. Our studio manager was David Stevens. Stay tuned for The Menu at 1900 London time. The Daily wraps the week up at 2200. Midori House returns on Monday at 1800. Until then, I'm Andrew Muller. Have a great weekend.